think the last time I saw you, although he wouldn't remember me because of such a crowded affair, was the Penn International Congress.
Oh, right.
Remember that one? That was about six, maybe seven years ago.
How could I forget it?
There hasn't been anything like that here since, has there?
No. Sad in a way. That, New York, I guess it's part of the recession and the budget crunch and some kind of general demoralization, but there's just a lot of fewer international things going on in New York. There used to be, there was that wonderful music and theater festival out in Purchase, and the, do you know about that?
No.
They used to bring things from all over. I mean, because the point of the Penn Congress was all these foreign writers and the chance to talk about international questions. And
it seems to me, though, you don't get that
in New York.
The major controversy was whether or not to allow the Secretary of State to speak as the keynote speaker, as I recall.
Well, that was the that's the event that got the most publicity. But I assure you, that was not what people were talking about in the Penn Congress. I mean, they were talking about all the obvious issues of censorship and writers in jail and the future of literature and political and engaged writing versus writing that had no political commitment. I mean, all the traditional things that writers talk about. That came up, and of course it was the kind of thing that people, the journalists wanted to talk about, because the then president of Penn had asked the Secretary of State, that was Norman Mailer, and hadn't checked it out with the membership. It really was a question of, he was so sure that we'd all be happy. And,
yeah, that,
and some
that,
people weren't so happy. For all I know, if he'd put it to the membership before, it would have gone through. But I don't think his intentions were bad, but there was a little procedural glitch.
Now, that conference was Norman's baby, and I think a lot of people thought he couldn't pull it off, but he actually did a very good job.
He did a wonderful job. He did a wonderful job. He had his priorities as president of Penn, and I had mine because I came after him. And didn't have a conference to play with, but he raised the money for it, essentially. I mean, he was the main person who knew who to touch, and there were other people as well. Gay Talese was very important, and it cost an awful lot of money, too.
Were you there when Erika Jong stalked up to the microphone and shouted to Mailer, "You are forgetting women," and Mailer said, "We can never forget you, Erika."
Yeah, those are the sorts of exchanges which don't do anyone credit. It always seems like grandstanding to me. But a lot of women at the conference were angry. Mailer has not shown himself as sensitive as he might or as other people have to the question of representing women in various capacities or taking women seriously. I mean,
well, there
going
are people
all the
who
way
think
back.
He's mellowed a great deal in his
mellowed.
Old age.
He has mellowed. I hope I haven't mellowed. I don't think that's the job. One's job is to mellow, but it is one's job to stay alert and listen to people and listen to what they say. And
you were president of Penn at one point, weren't you?
No, as I just said, I succeeded Mailer. I was the next president.
You were the next president, yeah.
I was the next president. And and I had a very different idea of what to do, and everyone who gets a crack at being president of Penn does it in his or her own style. Then after me came Larry McMurtry, who was president for 2 years, who was a wonderful president. And now there's a man named Ed McKeeley, who's a scholar, a literary scholar, which is a little different from the kind of person who's president of Penn in the past, but he's great too. It's a great organization. It's very necessary. It matters a lot. It's always our quarrelsome side that makes it into the papers. Fights with patrons, fights between well-known writers, but of course that's not what it's really about.
Well, we don't have too much time, so we want to talk about the Volcano Letter, which is your new novel. I had heard of these characters as historical figures. I didn't know anything about them. I mean, I knew Lord Nelson was a famous admiral. He beat the French, and that's really about all I knew. But when you embarked upon the Volcano Lover, did you have what sort of background did you have with regard to these characters?
Well, in order to start a novel that's based on real people, what's called, for want of a better word, a historical novel. You have to have a feeling for them. You have to know a little bit about them. And I had gotten interested, well, as you said, everybody knows who Lord Nelson is, and I'd gotten interested in the figure of the man in the triangle, because it is a story of a triangle, among other things. That was a man named Sir William Hamilton, who was an aristocrat, who was a famous art collector, diplomat. He was the British ambassador to Naples. Naples was at that time, Italy wasn't yet unified, this is the end of the 18th century, and the Italian peninsula was divided into several countries, and the country in the southern part, from above Naples to the bottom of the boot, and then including Sicily, was a country called the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. Capital was Naples. Hamilton came as ambassador there in 1764, and that was in fact, he didn't think he was going to stay very long. He thought he'd move on to other and more interesting posts, but it was the only post he ever had. And he was there for 37 years. He came with a wife who was a harpsichord player, a very distinguished and interesting woman, not an aristocrat, though, an heiress whom he had married. He was the fourth son of a lord, so he didn't inherit any of his family's money. And then the wife died, and into Hamilton's life came a very famous woman who was the great beauty of the age, already famous, though she was only 21 years old, and Hamilton was at that time 56. But she was the favorite model of the most important portrait painters of the time. So she was very well known. That woman became his second wife, not right away, because she was very humbly born. She was supposed to be a mistress rather than a wife, but Hamilton did fall madly in love with her, and to everyone's surprise and shock, married her. And that's the famous Emma Hamilton. But a little later in the story comes the great British admiral, chasing Napoleon's fleet, and Emma, Hamilton's second wife, and Nelson fall in love. So you have a terrific story and a background of extraordinary historical events. What did I know? Well, I saw the famous movie of 50 years ago. I didn't see it 50 years ago, but I did see it when I was a child. That Hamilton woman with Laurence Olivier playing Nelson.
No, I never saw. I didn't know that was about the same character.
That's right. It's about these characters. It was a movie made by Alexander Korda in 1941. It is 50 years ago. And actually, I didn't see it when it came out, but I saw it only a couple of years later, because I was a child and going to the movies in the 1940s. So I knew. I didn't know about him. About Hamilton himself. I knew about Emma and Nelson because, of course, you remember Vivien Leigh and Laurence Olivier, who were married, who were sort of the, I guess the Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton on a higher level of the day. They were not only these famous actors, but a celebrated glamorous couple, and then playing lovers in this movie, which is a very popular movie. And Winston Churchill is supposed to have said it was his favorite movie and he'd seen it 40 times. I don't know if that's true.
I think I have it on videotape. I'm going to have to drag that out.
Yeah, I actually, a friend who knew I was working on the novel gave me the videotape, so I had a chance to watch it after all these decades. It certainly made me laugh because I'd become so involved in my characters and recreating them and, in part, of course, basing them on the real people, but taking lots of liberties as well. I think that the challenge and the fun of writing a historical novel is to get it right in many important places and to take enormous liberties also, because it is a novel. It's not a work of history. At the same time, I think it's a real pleasure to become immersed in the historical events. I mean, after all, to take an obvious and grandiose example, War and Peace is a historical novel. I mean, all those events took place before Tolstoy was born. He had to do a lot of reading to find out about Napoleon's invasion of Russia. He was writing at the end of the 19th century. The events in War and Peace are taking place at the beginning of the 19th century. How much I knew about it? Well, I didn't know a lot. I have lots of books, and I realized when I went back to read books about Napoleon and the French Revolution, I saw them underlined in my light pencil underlining, so I knew I'd read them, but of course I had forgotten a lot of what I read. At the same time, somewhere it must have soaked in. I had some feeling for the period, and when I began the book, I just had the idea of the triangle and and the things that these people were interested in.
But what was the spark that initiated
the spark
the idea
was
of
the psychology of the collector. It actually, I have to say, it didn't begin with the triangle. The spark was, I've known a lot of collectors, and I think they have a very distinctive take on things, a very distinctive temperament. And I thought, here's this guy, and I found out about him because I bought in a bookshop in London near the British Museum some plates from a book that he had published while he was ambassador in 1776 in Naples. He had privately published this book, I think, in 150 copies. His great passion, besides collecting, was the volcano, Vesuvius, which had become very active suddenly after about a century of being more or less dormant. 2 years, let's see, he came to Naples in 1765, it started to smoke. In 1766, there was a quite a sizable eruption, although there were many bigger ones still to come. And then it was continually active in the next 3 decades when he was there. He got interested in the volcano. He was a person who was interested in everything. He climbed, he observed, he collected mineral specimens, and he started to write articles to an English scholarly academy. Eventually, he published these, as I said, in 1776 with these beautiful images that he commissioned from a local Neapolitan artist. But there were about 150 of these books, I suppose, over the 2 centuries. Half of them certainly have disappeared, fire, loss, water, who knows how they were destroyed. About a quarter of them are in various great libraries and in the homes of the extremely rich. I happen to know, for instance, that Sophia Loren owns a copy because a friend of mine visited her and saw it on her coffee table. It's a collector's item. One comes up for sale almost every year at Christie's. But at least a quarter of those original 150 copies have wandered into hands of booksellers who break them up and sell the prints separately. And that's how I came across them.
So you saw some prints?
Yeah. There are 55 prints in the book, and I went into this print shop, and I was looking through a lot of stuff, and I saw about 20 of these colored images of the volcanic landscape and Vesuvius in particular. And two of them I've used as the front of the cover on the front and in the back of the book. The front cover shows a daytime view of Vesuvius with this enormous, almost mushroom cloud above it. It is the eruption of 1799, actually, because it comes from a supplement to the book that Hamilton published in 3 years later. And the back of the jacket is the same eruption in a night view. It's the same day, actually, same day and night. So I bought, unfortunately, not all of the prints, but most of them. They were very cheap. I didn't know what they were. Somebody in the shop, I asked who did these, and they got out their information, and they told me Sir William Hamilton, who was he? They brought out a biographical dictionary and showed me that. And I said, oh, that Hamilton man. Because then I did remember, of course, the story of Emma Hamilton and Nelson. And the whole thing just started to grow. First subterraneanly, you know. Like,
so it was you were looking into the psychology of Hamilton as a collector initially.
As a collector, well, first I was so fascinated by the idea that this man would be a collector, and the psychology of that is all about conservation, preservation, being very careful, being very prudent. I mean, on the simplest level, don't touch it, don't knock it, watch out, you're going to drop it. I mean, it's all about taking care of things, rescuing things, saving things, putting them on shelves, guarding them, making sure that nothing happens to them. I mean, it's conservative in the literal sense. If ever there is an example of the conservative temperament, it would be the collector, who after all is conserving the past, because most objects come from the past. And then somebody who was that same person, the collector, simultaneously fascinated and obsessed with this immense destructive force. I mean, it would seem as paradoxical as somebody who is who's a collector, and the other thing is that person is a student of hurricanes and tornadoes. Say, well, how do the two go together? And it started with thinking about the beauty of these images, the interest of that period, which, although it's 200 years ago, really is the beginning of the modern age, and all sorts of interesting problems and ways that people think and feel. The modern stuff is really starting then. and the psychology of this person. That's why, also, when I write something, I have to have the title first. So I had the title in my mind, The Volcano Lover, before I put one word on paper. And then I really thought it was mainly about him, and the Emma Nelson story would kind of come in the background. But after I got into the book, which I did write, you know, consecutively, you know, first chapter and then the second chapter, I didn't jump ahead. Then Emma came into the book about a third way into it and sort of kidnapped the book, because she's such an incredible character and so alive. And, well, I think the real person was, and certainly the one I've reinvented and added a lot of things that may not be true of the original person, but she's a great character. And this self-made, well, she's just the opposite of Hamilton.
I want to go back to Hamilton the Collector for a minute, because there's an interesting glimpse of Hamilton's psychology, and whether this is actually true or springs from your imagination, I don't know. But at one point in the book, to avert the invasion by the French, Hamilton sends back a collection of vases to England.
Right.
And it's sunk, and of course he's devastated by it. But toward the end of the book, when he is living in England, there is a theft of a cloth cover from his carriage that seems to devastate him even more than the loss of those vases.
Well, that's a very shrewd observation that you're making, because what I'm trying to show there, and I'm so delighted that you saw the paradox of it. He loses 1,000 priceless Greek vases, which are sunk in a storm. I mean, understandably, he's devastated. Then, some years later, and not so many years later, some sort of velveteen cloth that covers the top of the coach and is stolen when he makes a stop somewhere, and he's devastated. What this is about is his decline. And when, at the moment that he's sending the vases back in the eve of the French invasion of Naples, and he decides to send them back for safety, well, actually he needs the money, wants to sell them, he's still in his glory. He still he isn't old. I mean, he may be old chronologically. He was already well in his 60s at that time. He was in his late 60s. But he was an exceptionally vigorous man. He was very intellectual. At the same time, he was a great sportsman and athlete. He hunted, he climbed the mountain. He was a superb athlete. He's still going strong at that moment. And the fact that he could be so upset by the loss or theft of something so trivial only a few years later is really the marker of his decline, his defeat as a human being. You know, this is the kind of thing that you can get to do in a novel that you can't do in a short story. A short story, you can't really change. You can't show people changing their character or evolving or aging. A story will give you essentially stable characters to whom perhaps some revelation or moment of insight or something happens to them, but they're still the same people. But in a novel, I guess what makes a novel different from a story is not just that it's longer, of course it's longer, but that in that length, the people grow and change. You see these people become old. You see what happened. You see Emma, for instance, this great beauty, the greatest beauty of the age, the one admired by everybody, internationally famous as a beauty. You see what happens to her, how she thinks about herself, and how other people think about her when she loses her looks. And when she loses her looks by the standards by which she was judged as a very young woman, you see the problem of aging. You see the problem of people becoming losers, people who were winners becoming losers, and how they react to that. And essentially what happened to Hamilton is he became a loser. He made the wrong political moves as ambassador, and he was recalled. He was fired from his job instead of being allowed gracefully to retire with a handsome pension. And he was very humiliated. He was also humiliated by the loss of his wife, or the affection of his wife. Though they remained a trio, he was saying to himself and trying to make himself believe it, what do I expect? I'm 36 years older than my wife. I knew when I married her that one day something else would happen. I've had her love and affection for many, many years. How wonderful that for the first time when she is interested in somebody else because she'd been completely faithful to him, she falls in love with a man whom I enormously admire, who is also much younger than I am. So it's as if, well, I'll now be their father. I have a son, and I'm happy for them, and this is the way it should be, and I must resign myself. These are still young people compared to me. That's what he kept telling himself, because he was the sort of person who tried always to be very rational. In fact, he was deeply wounded and hurt, and that was part of what he assimilated, and that comes out almost emblematically in being so upset by the loss of a trivial object.
It wasn't completely clear to me whether or not Hamilton recognized the fact that Emma did have a child. She was discreet in not having the child there and raising the child elsewhere. I'm talking about the child with Nelson.
Right. When you look at the documents and the letters of the period, it is not clear. People were not convinced that he knew. I'm convinced that he did know. I don't see how. He adored this woman. They shared a household. I mean, they obviously didn't share a bedroom anymore, but then wealthy people with large living spaces, couples never shared, had a common bedroom. But there's no way that he couldn't have known. There's no way that he couldn't have known. What he did was, I believe, spare her the necessity of having a lot of discussions with him about it and asking for his understanding. He simply left the house whenever she had she sent the child out to be taken care of. But she would have the child brought to the house once a week, and he would always manage to be someplace else and come back after the child had gone back to the family, the people that were raising the child. And then when the child, as soon as Hamilton died, of course, Emma brought the child to live with her. However, she didn't treat her very well, which is interesting. And
as we find out on her deathbed.
That's right. The book ends with one of the last scenes in the book is a terrible scene in which Emma is dying, drunk and penniless, having gone to debtor's prison and then fled England. And she has now this child of Nelson, who's a 14-year-old girl, and she behaves horribly to her. You know, I'm talking to you as if these are real people, and at the same time, they're people I've created. And that's, of course, the wonderful excitement of working with real people. This is a terrific story, but there are lots of terrific stories. And what matters is what you can add to a story. I mean, if you just tell a story, I think you can't tell that it's a... Take the story of Hamlet. It actually isn't a very appealing story if you think about it. There's this young man who's a prince, and he's in college, and he has a best friend named Horatio, and then he finds out that suddenly his father has not only died, but his mother has married his uncle, and he goes back to court, and he hangs around and sulks and makes everybody very uncomfortable and threatens people but doesn't do anything about it and seems to be having a nervous breakdown, etc., etc., etc. It doesn't sound like a great story.
It sounds like a Raymond Carver story.
Right. why it's a great story is everything that Shakespeare put into it. And so in the same way, although I can say, because I think the novel really works, that this is a great story, it's a great story because of what you can attach to it, in the way of... I don't know, showing people feeling.
But I would imagine, as you wrote it, you became involved in their lives as a participant, practically, or as one of them.
I thought about them morning, noon, and night. I dreamt about them. I lent them characteristics of myself without even meaning to. I identified with all of them, all the main characters, to some extent, none of them have lives that in any way correspond to or include incidents that are the same as my life, except on a certain level, of course they do. I mean, they felt, they grieved, they loved, they wanted things, they were disappointed. I mean, we all have those experiences. When I was writing the book, it was an absolutely exalting time. You did ask me earlier about how much I knew. Well, I didn't know very much, but I kept looking things up as I went along, and then when I finished it, I checked a lot of things that I...
Well, I was going to ask you, after you finished this thought, to tell me a little bit about the research that you did.
Well, it wasn't any research. It was just checking. I can't dignify...
But you have so many historical descriptions. You describe the clothes, for example, and the bloodthirsty... killings and executions
But I read the newspapers. Actually, the killing of the Duke... That horrifying scene of the murder of the Duke and his brother when, you know, and toward the end of the book, all that, when the Neapolitan Revolution gets underway, a part of that description of the actual murder of the Duke, which is so gruesome, was taken from a description that I read in the New York Times of the of some contemporary political butchery going on in this particular case in Liberia. It's the murder of the president of Liberia. And I took some details from the description of how he was tortured and murdered, and adapted it to that scene. So the present was impinging all the time, and details came in from the present. I mean, that's the interest of it. I mean, I think that's why it's good, if I may be so immodest as to say. It's not a novel which makes you think while you're reading it, oh, you are there. It's a novel which is obviously written now, in the early 1990s, with, with all the advantages of hindsight.
All sorts of references. But Disney-esque, I think, is a term
right,
that you use.
Yes, and I compare Nelson to Lawrence of Arabia, who obviously came much later. But it isn't just the little sort of dots of color, which, you know, which are anachronistic, where I'll compare something then to something now, so you hear the author's voice. It's the fact that the conception of the scenes and the feeling is, well, it has, at least for me as I wrote it, that's not for me to say what the reader will get out of it. I know that the modern parallels or comparisons were in my head. If I wrote about the failure of the Neapolitan Revolution, I know somewhere in my mind there was the failure of the Nicaraguan Revolution. And that was shaping the way I described those events in Naples in 1799. I think it should be like that. I don't mean that somebody else wouldn't write a novel that takes place in the past in another way, and that wouldn't work too. For instance, I'm a great admirer of a book called The Memoirs of Hadrian by Marguerite Yourcenar, in which Yourcenar recreates the mental and physical world of the Roman emperor, so that you feel that's how he must have been. You're just inside his head. It's told in the first person, and you're completely convinced that this is authentic. And she had steeped herself in that period and literature so much that she could write a long first-person book. The Emperor Hadrian is saying I. And there's no modern reference. You just feel it's like you're in a time capsule. You're back there. This is not at all that kind of book. You're in 1992 reading about these things. It opens out into all sorts of themes and feelings which are our concern, to quarrel with them, to contrast them, or whatever. The subject, I guess, if there is a subject, is passion. It's different kinds of passion: the passion for art, the passion for collecting, the passion for glory, political passions, the passion for beauty. All these people are motivated by passion. And it's the collision of their passions which is the story. But there are a lot of things to be said about passion. It isn't. People think that feeling or emotion is something self-evident. It's really not self-evident at all.
Are you a collector yourself?
I think I'm a repressed collector. I'm an accumulator. I'm a pack rat. I find it very hard to throw anything out, whether it's letters or clippings or programs from a concert or theater. And I have a lot of books, but I don't think that's that's not collecting. With another life and money, yes, I think I very well could have been a collector.
Certainly not on the scale of William Hamilton, I would assume.
Well, there are people in this country who are collecting on the scale of William Hamilton and better. I've known a number of collectors, and most of them have been extremely rich, and they have very grand collections. There are a lot of people in this country who are great collectors of different kinds. But the collecting thing is really the concern for the object as a material object. For instance, I have thousands and thousands of books, and people say, oh, well, obviously you're a collector, but I'm not a collector because I don't care what edition it is. A ninth edition is the same. I don't look to see what the edition is of the book I'm buying. A rare book doesn't mean more to me than, a well-sewn paperback with acid-free paper. I mean, what matters to me is what's in the book, not the age of the book or the status of the book as an object. Book
well, that
collectors,
separates you from William Hamilton, then.
Yeah, book collectors, but there are book collectors in this country who will collect, sometimes on really eccentric principles. I've heard of someone who collects only books with red covers. I've heard of people who collect only books about a given theme or period or whatever. I just buy books because I'm interested in reading them. And it's not about the book as an object. It's not about the book having more value in this condition or that condition. So I think you have to distinguish between collecting and accumulating. I'm an accumulator. And that's one of the things that the book talks about, of course, in context of their lives.
We're almost out of time. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. You became well known with this essay on camp that was written, I guess, in the
30 years ago,
30
almost.
Years ago. Now, you know, that's a term that we don't hear anymore. When was the last time you heard anybody use the term camp?
Well, I never have used it in my life. It's not... first of all, I suppose it's a great tribute that people are still talking about an essay written almost 30 years ago. I guess it was 1964. There aren't very many essays, if any at all, from that period that people remember or still talk about. And yes, that essay created a storm, was talked about and reprinted and discussed. And
what's the difference between camp and kitsch?
Gosh, I don't remember. I don't remember. I think kitsch is just junk.
I think kitsch is junk, yeah.
But camp is really in the eye of the beholder. It's so interesting. Now, I don't think I've ever had a conversation about camp. Because at the time I wrote the essay, I was invited to, I don't know, make a television series out of it, an article in Life magazine, everything except a musical comedy and bubblegum cards. And I said, no, I just published this essay. It's all I have to say. It's funny all these years. But it wasn't my term. It was a term that I heard. I've read it in some things of Auden and Isherwood. I heard a friend use the term in Paris. And I was spending the summer in Paris in the summer of 1964. And I said, oh, what's that? And he said, oh, you know. And then, of course, he offered a completely inarticulate, I know it when I see it, but I can't really tell you what it is. And then I had this idea, well, I'd use, you're right in bringing up kitsch, because I thought, is there a sense in which what we might dismiss as kitsch could be seen with affection and irony? And there is there a sense that sort of melodramatic, over-the-top, exaggerated, it's like the art of exaggeration, that could be a certain taste, a certain adjunct or wing of a mainstream sensibility. The thing that people didn't get, and why I never wanted to talk about it, is I guess people think if you write about something, that must be what you think, or that must be the main thing you think. Well, I don't think I have camp taste. I mean, or maybe I have a little annex or wing, I learned, it's part of becoming a little more sophisticated and knowing people who sort of introduce you to things. I have very mainstream, traditional taste in the arts. And then I thought, oh, well, you know, lighten up. There's also another way of looking, more ironically. And then I got interested in the whole question of exaggeration. You know, like Busby Berkeley. What do you think when you look at a Busby Berkeley movie? Is that good? It's certainly not good. When you see people dancing in a Busby Berkeley movie, they're not dancing the way, say, Fred Astaire dances. I mean, Fred Astaire really is a great dancer. That's not camp. He's a terrific, important dancer. When you look at Busby Berkeley, what is it? It's about exaggeration. It's in a way, humorous. So it was an attempt to define
He's
that sensibility.
He's made bad taste enjoyable.
But really talented bad for taste.
The
talent's got to be there. If the talent isn't there, it doesn't work. I mean, it's, as I say, not a term I ever used in my life.
You're going to have to start going to some old camp meetings.
That's something else. And anyway, I think that in the innocent early 60s, you see, it was possible to say, look, there's this too, and not realize that it would become sort of an industry, and certainly not anticipate how kitsch has so much taken over everything. I mean, I would never write that essay now, even if I knew what I knew then. Now, I wouldn't write it, because one does not want to appear to be an accomplice of garbage, and we're just drowning in garbage and drivel. You know, then it seemed as if you could still hold on to the mainstream, high-minded, serious things, and you could say, but also there's this. But the cultural standards have turned out to be much more fragile than I imagined in the early 60s.
I don't want to keep dredging up references to essays of the past, but there was one that struck me, I read some time ago, and that was when you said that science fiction was essentially the same as pornography. Now, do you still hold that view? Now, I guess that should be explained, that that science fiction is not pornographic per se, nor is pornography science fiction.
Well, I think I meant to say that pornography is science fiction. Actually, that's what I did mean to say. I'm a little...
What you were saying, I think, was that it's all fantasy.
It's totally unrealistic. I mean, as a woman, I cannot but despise and fear pornography, because so much of pornography, of course, is confirming degrading stereotypes of women. Nevertheless, as a staunch civil libertarian, I have to grit my teeth and say no censorship for any grounds whatsoever. So that too is a problem. But, you know, I don't mind you bringing up essays from the past. It's very enjoyable and gratifying to think that those essays were good enough that they still seem worth reading 30 years later. But that was a very early period of my work in which I certainly did not understand how ideas and opinions circulate. I think I'm a little wiser now, and I prefer to embed my ideas and opinions in fiction. Fiction is a much larger form than essays. My characters can have ideas, or this book can have ideas, and they're not necessarily my ideas, and I prefer... I've stopped writing essays and fiction, more novels, I hope as good as this one, if not better.
But you understand, everyone wants to find an idea, a new idea to hold.
I don't want to find a new idea. I don't. I want to go on seeing things as more complicated than they appear at first. What I like is when you see how complicated things are. I'm so afraid of reductiveness, which is why the right direction for me to go is to concentrate and devote myself entirely to fiction. In fiction, you can really honor the complexity of people's feelings and of a historical situation. You can see how many points of view have validity, and that inside one idea there's another idea which in some way contradicts it. I'm interested in that complexity, and I tried to get some of it into the essays, but still the essays is just one voice, the voice of the essayist, whereas a novel is many voices. That's what I like about a novel.
Well, fiction is my passion, but that's what I focus on primarily with my broadcast, and it's my personal interest. But I've noticed that there is a tremendous resistance among many people to fiction. And for the most part, if I read Publishers Weekly correctly, nonfiction vastly outsells fiction.
I don't know that that's true, but it sounds quite plausible. I mean, I'm not contradicting you, I just don't know that that's true. It's probably so. Anyway, maybe I can help change that, because this is a novel which is a novel of passion and a terrific story, and it's also a novel of ideas. Maybe people have given up on the novel. I mean, they don't stretch it enough. I think there's everything that can be done in the novel.
I have a theory, and maybe you could comment on it. You're talking about historical characters, and obviously there are biographies of these characters. But somehow in fiction, even though you might take liberties as a fiction writer, you somehow can get into the hearts and the souls and the minds of these people in a way that a biographer just cannot do.
Absolutely. And that's what I try to do, and that's why I'm now really in love with doing things that have a connection with real people, but at the same time move out from them and invent. I mean, I am starting another novel. It's the only way I can keep my sanity while this one is being published and doing very well. I have a new novel in my head, which I have to think about. And again, it won't be research, but I have to read in the period. And this one's going to take place in the 19th century, which in some ways is more remote than the 18th century. This is a very accessible period.
You're probably going to hate me, but I just have to ask you this. I was reading... you have a photograph in the current Vanity Fair.
Yes.
And but there's also an article about Camille Paglia.
Yeah, I haven't read it.
Well, I wouldn't expect you to. But she says,
I don't really want to.
I have no rivals. The only true challenger, Susan Sontag, has abdicated the race, says Paglia with a gloat that could girdle the globe. I've been chasing the bitch for 25 years, and at last I've passed her. You're not going to escalate that into any kind of...
I don't know who Camille Pelly is.
I don't know either. I'd never heard of her until I saw something on page 6. Never read a thing, and then here's this long article in Vanity Fair. And you haven't read it?
No, I haven't read it.
And you're not going to get into any argument with someone...
I don't get into arguments with people I don't know.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, Volcano Lover, it's Susan Sontag, it's a really beautiful book. And it's interesting. Oh, I just one other thing. In terms of the structure of the book, I noticed there are no quotation marks. It threw me off a little bit. But why did you decide to use that form?
It seemed more intense. I don't know. It was purely intuitive. It actually created a little problem sometime to make sure that the reader knew who quotation marks are a great invention. So I had to be careful that I want this novel to be absolutely clear, absolutely readable and enjoyable. And sometimes there was a question of paragraphing and spacing to make it work. But I just felt it was more intense. I tried it one day. I'd been writing. I don't know, about the 30 some odd page of the book. And I thought, what happens if I take the quotation marks off? And it just looked right. It's not a gimmick, but it just felt right. I don't know if I'll ever do it again.
Once I started reading, I had no problem with it. I got caught up in it and I ignored it. And in terms of clarity, if there were any areas that were not clear, you fix that at the end with the summaries of each of the major characters,
right,
looking at what happened through their own particular perspective, and so that would clarify anything that might have been vague to a reader. It's certainly a beautifully done book, Susan Sontag. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don't be mad at me for asking about Camille Paglia, please.
Are you really going to use that?
There's nothing to use.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to convince you.